Hey guys, welcome to this afternoon's symposium. I want to call your attention to the coffee that is going to be set up on the back table. Feel free at any time to go back and get a cup. I think we have two caffeinated tanks and one decaffeinated. Thanks as always to Jeff for getting us through this 2.5 hour gathering. The way we'll proceed is Professor Harawas will give his paper or a summation of his paper in about a half an hour, and Professor McCarr will do the same, and then we'll have a time for question and answer. At some point, we'll probably take a break. I know some of you have other obligations, and then reconvene for another half hour or 40 minutes of hopefully lively, convivial discussion. So welcome. This is to those of you who are visiting. This is, in fact, a 5,000-level seminar called Bonhoeffer, Niebuhr, King, Theologies of Resistance and Reconciliation. And in the course of the semester, we invite three outside scholars or writers to bring their work and their research to our attention. And we are thrilled today to have two rock stars, two just extraordinary, look at you just both being so humble about this. But these are two people who I feel to be not only mentors and encouragers and fearless scholars and theologians, but soul brothers in a profound sense. We began the semester with a look at a fascinating document, letter of sorts, that Bonhoeffer wrote to his family in just after Christmas 1942, a few months before his arrest. And in that letter that sometimes goes by the name After 10 Years, Bonhoeffer asked a question that haunts us in our exchanges and collaborations in this course, but I think in our exchange today. He's surveying the ruins of the German church that had, as you know, made a Faustian bargain and in exchange for a short-lived legitimacy by the Nazi state, accepted the full slate of Teutonic and increasingly pagan ideals, and went about recasting doctrines, setting up institutes such as the one Susanna Heschel narrates in her Aryan Jesus, that were dedicated to the eradication of all Jewishness in the Christian faith. And he's also in this letter, Bonhoeffer, speaking to his humanist family and fellow members of the Berlin-based conspiracy, and asking questions about the usefulness of Christian conviction and of virtue as character in the wake of this great masquerade of evil. And towards the end of this remarkable letter, he asked, are we still of any use? And he will ask this question in various forms throughout his prison writings. He's asking, not only is the culture of the Bildungsbürgertum, the sort of educated upper middle class, the kind of literary and cultural and corporate elites who funded and often peopled many of the conspiracy movements in northern Germany. But he's also asking this question of the Christian tradition. He will ask a series of questions that remain, in some respects, unanswered in those last years. He asks, who is Christ for us today? He'll ask such questions as, is the time of words over? Is the time when the language of faith has been so profaned and cheapened by its affiliation with partisan loyalties that it has lost the power to speak its or bespeak its mysteries in a manner that moves and stirs and energizes and convicts? He asks the question, if the time of words is over, the time of inwardness, is not the time of religion past as well, the age of religion? These are the kinds of probing questions that I think have, again, resonance in our own current political and historic situation, and are the kind that will surface in our exchanges this afternoon. In the course, we are now at the point where we are moving from Bonhoeffer into Niebuhr. Many of the students will have read Children of Light, Children of Darkness for the day. Last week, they read the memoir from Detroit, Leaves. And we have finished Bonhoeffer and have our eyes set on King and the Beloved Community. It's a good time to ask the question, Bonhoeffer, Niebuhr, are they still of any use? How do they matter? And in what ways are their witnesses, their projects, their theological commitments illuminative? In what ways perhaps might they be clouding our sense of what to do? So you don't need long introductions. Stanley Hauerwas is known to every one of you. I will say, just beyond the record of his astonishing accomplishments and awards and professorships, that I have known Stanley for 30 years to be, though a theologian, a scholar I did not work with as a graduate student, to me an encourager and a scholar theologian who models generosity. And it's an honor to call you a friend. Jean McCarer will come up immediately after Stanley. Jean McCarer, many of you know, is the author of Christian Critics. Any graduate student who's ever taken comps with me knows that you can't get through those comps without reading Christian Critics. It's a stunning book. And we celebrate with Jean today the fabulous news that the book that you've been working on for about a decade now, parts of which you've shared with us over the years, will be coming out with Harvard University Press in the fall, provisionally titled The Enchantments of Mammon, but I guess Harvard may want you to think about whether enchantments is the right word.
I'll think about it and
they'll be wrong. They'll be wrong. Okay. So, look, welcome both of you. Thanks so much for being here.
Can y'all all, you can hear me, can't you? Yeah. Well, it's wonderful to be here and to be with Charles and Karen and be back at University of Virginia. I've actually taught here, I guess, five or six times. Every time someone would go on sabbatical in the Department of Religion, they'd haul me up from Durham. I'm going to talk about Bonhoeffer primarily, but I want to begin with Reinhold Niebuhr. If anyone has a deserved reputation for being a Niebuhr basher, it's me. I have developed a career of criticizing Reinhold Niebuhr. But I want to give you a sense of the power of Niebuhr in his time. And I do so by quoting a passage from Langdon Gilkey, a very prominent theologian that taught here at Virginia after he retired from the University of Chicago. And he, toward the end of his life, he wrote a book, Reinhold, just Reinhold Niebuhr. And Gilkey had been a prisoner in the Shangtung compound when Japan overtook China. And it was a terrible experience. But when he came back, he went to Harvard. And he had pretty well given up his faith by being at Harvard. And his father, having been a Chinese missionary, kept urging him not to do that. And his father knew that Reinhold Niebuhr was coming to Harvard to preach. And he told Langdon that he should go hear Niebuhr. This is what follows. He says, "As before, I had no idea who Niebuhr was, but went out of curiosity and out of respect for my father. The torrent of words, insights, and ideas that issued forth from that towering figure in the pulpit stunned me. This was not gentle and apologetic persuasion rounding out our nice, ordinary experience with a moral and religious interpretation. This was, from the beginning to end, a challenge to the assumption of my sophisticated modernity. And that challenge came with a vividly new interpretation of my world. In fact, a quite different viewpoint on everything was set before me, a viewpoint in which my confused and deeply troubled ordinary experience suddenly clarified itself, righted, and became for the moment intelligible. There was here no appeal to an extrinsic authority. On the contrary, there was an exceedingly realistic analysis of just the social situation that was troubling me. But this was an analysis structured by a framework, a wider ontological framework, which was very new to me. It was, in fact, one of which I had never before been really conscious. To my astonishment, Niebuhr identified his own utterly realistic appraisal of the domestic and international situation, much more real than of my philosophical mentors of Russell, Dewey, and Santayana, with what he called the biblical viewpoint. Further, he pointed out not only the naive optimism of the humanist and naturalistic philosophers I had treasured, but even more the experiential validity and moral strength of this other, biblical perspective. I felt overwhelmed, as if I'd stepped into another space, one in which a new quality of light changed the social scene, which was once obscure, into what could now be comprehended. In short, Niebuhr opened up the possibility of a realism about social affairs that did not lead to cynicism, and yet, on the contrary, led to a confidence in transcendence that supported a renewed and re-strengthened moral commitment. I was no means converted, but I was thoroughly disturbed and deeply intrigued. I turned to a fellow philosopher student who sat there staring and asked, "Who in the hell was that?" "Don't you know that's Reinhold Niebuhr, professor at Union Seminary in New York? He really stirs things up when he comes here." On my way out, I asked a student assistant in the chapel if the preacher was speaking again in Cambridge. "Yes, this afternoon in Christchurch, and then once again this evening." I went to both, listened enthralled, and never recovered. Within 2 weeks, I had bought and read hungrily three of his books. By the end of that time, my understanding of almost everything had thoroughly changed, and for the first time, I regarded myself as a Christian. If you ever want to read a conversion narrative, that's it. That Niebuhr had that kind of effect is why, there is an anti-Hauerwas society made up of Niebuhrians that cannot believe I would criticize a man like that. Well, let me say something about Bonhoeffer. In performing the faith, Bonhoeffer and the practice of nonviolence, I suggested that Bonhoeffer's theological politics is best understood as the attempt to recover the visibility of the church. The church in Germany, according to Bonhoeffer, had become invisible because Luther, to be sure in his peculiar way, had confirmed Constantine's covenant with the church. The result, particularly in Germany, was to institutionalize a minimal ethic for everyone. Such an ethic meant that the existence of the Christian became indistinguishable from the existence of the German citizen. Bonhoeffer argued that that development had the effect of making the church vanish into an invisible realm. I think this aspect of Bonhoeffer as an anti-Constantinian is not appropriately appreciated. I mean, Constantine, of course, knew how to deal with Christians. He legalized them. And before Constantine, Christians had faith that God was active in the church, but they had to have faith that God was present in the world because the world was beating the shit out of them. After Constantine, Christians knew God was present in the world because the world was treating them pretty well. Now they had to have faith that God was present in the church. So that's what happened to invisibility. The realm of invisibility, Bonhoeffer suggested, had a name. The name was religion. Religion was assumed to be an unavoidable aspect of the human condition. Christianity was one form of religion. You could take it or leave it. By calling attention to religion as the concept necessary to make the church invisible, Bonhoeffer, I suspect, was suggesting that the tradition of Protestant liberalism associated with the name of Schleiermacher functioned to make Christianity a legitimation of the high humanism of German life. In that tradition, a generalized anthropology was thought necessary to sustain Christianity as a civilizational faith. I mean, Niebuhr is a perfect exemplification of this. You don't talk much about God, but you talk about insights about the human condition. Liberal Protestants might emphasize the importance of the church for the formation of individuals, but the fundamental problem remained the same. Namely, once Christianity became religion, it becomes almost impossible to think of the church, in Bonhoeffer's words, as Christ existing as church community. I mean, think of that phrase, Christ existing as church community. The Anglicans, which I happen to be one, actually, I understand now you have to be an Episcopalian in contradistinction with that, but I'm an Episcopalian. And the Church of England sponsored theologians that came up with a phrase that I think is not unlike what Bonhoeffer's about. It's that the church is the extension of the incarnation, a phrase that's you have to be very careful with. But Christ existing as church community is an extraordinarily strong claim theologically. Bonhoeffer's call in letters and papers from prison for a Christianity free of religion was not, as it has often been interpreted, as an underwriting of liberal Protestant theology. Rather, his call for Christianity free from religion was an implicit critique of the attempt by Protestant liberal theologians to defend Christianity by identifying what we believe as Christians with the presumed unavoidable religious aspect of the human condition. Oh, you've got an ultimate concern, you're religious. The result from Bonhoeffer's perspective was to legitimate an invisible church by confusing the gospel with some version of high humanism. Bonhoeffer called the form of that Christianity Methodism because it attempted to sustain Christianity on the margins of life rather than at the center. Bonhoeffer clearly thought the association of Christianity with inwardness had prepared the way for the failure of the church to oppose Nazis. This was made, by Christianity's inwardness in American context, that is when people say something like, I just believe Jesus is my personal Lord and Savior. I mean, save you from that. If that's all Jesus is for you, you can get along better without him. Bonhoeffer clearly thought the association of Christianity with inwardness prepared the way for the failure of the church to oppose the Nazis. This was made explicit in the Bethel Confession, in which these false doctrines were rejected. These are false doctrines. that the church is a religious association formed by gathering together of devout individuals, enlightenment, pietism, and liberalism. That the true church is invisible, and that every empirical church is only an imperfect attempt to realize the ideal of the true church, idealism. That the church could be a religious organization for a nation, so it would have to provide the religious foundation for that nation's ethno-national tradition, and that the territorial boundaries of that church should be the same as those of that nation. I assume that those three sound familiar to Americans. These were the presumptions Bonhoeffer tried to challenge by way he trained those studying for the ministry at Finkenwald. That training was proving, by the way, that training he was providing, the way the day was organized at the seminary, was Bonhoeffer attempted to train those in the ministry to be people capable of the kind of work necessary to recover the visibility of the church. Jeffrey Kelly, I think quite rightly in his introduction to Bonhoeffer's Life Together, directs our attention to the 1932 lecture, The Nature of the Church. In that lecture, Bonhoeffer makes explicit the pastoral implications of his earlier work, which was not surprising given the task he was taking on, that is, to train young men to serve the church that could resist being invisible. In this early lecture on the nature of the church, Bonhoeffer begins by observing that the visibility of any institution depends on having a place in the world, but that is exactly what the church lacks because it has tried at once to be everywhere, which has resulted in the church being nowhere. The ambition for the church to be everywhere has, moreover, had the ironic result that the church was turned into the world without the world being transformed. Bonhoeffer, with uncommon insight, suggests that such a worldly church cannot help but try to hide its own unfaithfulness, which results in contempt toward itself and the world. Because a church so constituted has abandoned its place in the world, it is hidden by privilege and exists primarily to meet the needs of the petite bourgeois. The God such a church represents, like the church itself, at once is everywhere and nowhere, having no concrete reality. According to Bonhoeffer, the proper place of the church, the place that makes possible the visibility of the church, is the place of Christ present in the world. Neither the state church nor some petite bourgeois center, for no human person but God alone determines this place. The church, which is aware of this, waits for the word that transforms it into God's place in the world. Bonhoeffer, therefore, is quick to challenge any suggestion that such a church needs to be ideal or perfect. Rather, the church is a reality in the world, being in fact a bit of the world itself. But the church is just as Jesus was, fully human, and that means the church must renounce the most deceptive form of invisibility, that is, the attempt to be pure. The emphasis upon the visibility of the church is clearly a theme begun in Sanctorum Communio, but Kelly quite rightly suggests that in subsequent essays entitled such as The Nature of the Church, Bonhoeffer began to draw out the practical implications of the work he had done. He told the students at Finkenwald that the church is no ideal church, but that does not mean that the church is not a reality in the world. Thus the church, the visible church, will be worldly by renouncing all privileges and property, but never will it renounce Christ's word and the forgiveness of sins. With Christ and the forgiveness of sins to fall back on, the church is free to give up everything else, and he meant property. In the afterword to Life Together, Gerard Mueller and Albrecht Schoner quote a draft of a speech written for pastors in 1942 by Bonhoeffer. In this fragment, Bonhoeffer addressed what pastors must do in the event of a successful overthrow of the regime, meaning the Nazis. Bonhoeffer called on those to whom he wrote to order their lives anew. He observes they have suffered too long from desires to go their own way and to separate them from their brothers. Such a separation is not in the spirit of Jesus, Bonhoeffer argued, but in the spirit of individualism, indolence, and defiance. Bonhoeffer makes the surprising suggestion, therefore, that to be so separated from one another results in the destruction of good preaching. The problem that is they sought to perform their duties without faithfully keeping regular times of prayer, contemplation, and study, as well as receiving from one another their personal confessions. As you know, at Finkenwald, he had the special group that confessed to one another. Accordingly, Bonhoeffer ends by imposing on each of those to whom he writes, quote, the sacred duty to be available to our brother for the ministry. We ask you to come together to pray as you prepare your sermons and to help one another find the proper words. To find the proper words strikes me as the great challenge for the recovery of the church's visibility a la Bonhoeffer. Consider, for example, Bonhoeffer's reflections in the Ethics, tellingly in the section Ethics as Formation, in which he describes how Hitler, the one who tyrannically despises humanity, makes use of the meanness of the human heart by giving it other names. Quote, anxiety is called responsibility. Greed is called industriousness. Lack of independence becomes solidarity. Brutality becomes masterfulness. The small number of people who oppose and expose such duplicity find that their courage is called revolt, their discipline Pharisaism, their independence arbitrariness, and their masterfulness arrogance. In short, this tyrannical despiser of humanity hides his distrust of all humanity behind the stolen words of true community. What an extraordinary phrase. These Orwellian reflections by Bonhoeffer are so interesting because Bonhoeffer locates the church's failure to call into question those stolen words to the church's desire to be politically relevant. As a result, Christians have failed to be properly visible. The irony is that the invisibility of the church is a correlative of the church's attempt to be politically relevant. An ambition that tempts the church to use foreign language, at least foreign for Christians, of what passes for political speech. The language, moreover, meant even Christians could be seduced by the Nazis, whose cynicism knew no limit. As I suggested, we are tempted to think we live in a very different time than Bonhoeffer. We are not threatened, we think, by Hitler-like leaders, but the cynicism that produced a Hitler remains alive and well. We do not trust our neighbors, nor do we trust ourselves, nor do we trust the church. In fact, many in the ministry prefer the church to be invisible. The invisibility of the church means that the primary role for those in the ministry is to be a pleasant person. I say, now that I'm back among the Methodists, I have discovered what the Methodists require of a minister, that they be perpetually nice. The invisibility of the church means that the primary role is to be a pleasant person. What seems lacking is anything that you are supposed to do as a Christian. But Bonhoeffer gives those in the ministry and all Christians something to do. And that is the great genius of Christianity. In a world where people are dying of boredom, we give you something to do. And that's what Bonhoeffer did. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I want to thank Charles once again, putting up with me. I'll just say at the beginning that if you came here to hear Niebuhr bashed, you will be in hog heaven for the next 30 to 40 minutes. But I do want to say that, to paraphrase Shakespeare, that I've come to praise Niebuhr just a little bit before I bury him. And I do think that he matters, though, in a negative way. More as an example of the way not to think about politics rather than as how. He's still celebrated and revered as a theologian thinking about politics, but I would agree with Stanley that he's had a harmful and even pernicious influence on the way that we think about politics. And so in that spirit, what better way to begin than to begin to bash his beloved Serenity Prayer? Which I think encapsulates a lot of the wisdom, but also hints at the shortcomings of his political theology, so I'll recite it just in case you don't know it, and if you don't know it, I don't know what you're doing here. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom always to know the difference. Now that's a memorable chestnut of piety, oft cited and admired as a wizening maxim of existential and political maturity. And its stoical spirit has been invoked by a roster of politicians and intellectuals. And as with so many of Niebuhr's pronouncements, we're all expected to stroke our chins and furrow our brows at its astringent gravitas, and take to heart his reminder that our sin and fittitude place inexorable limits on our ability to master the vicissitudes of history. But there are good reasons why Niebuhr is the perennial theological favorite of what I'll call very serious people. Those entrusted to wield or plump for the powers and principalities of rule and violence. Would we not want them to be serene and courageous and wise about when to be one or the other? Yet I think this prayer also reflects everything that's anemic and debilitating about Niebuhr's political theology. The serenity it counsels turns far too easily into complacence and resignation. The courage it affirms flexes its muscles within far too narrow a compass. And the serenity, I think, congeals, and the courage withers, because the wisdom they demand, otherwise known as Christian realism, derives from the canons of reality as defined by very serious people. Now, while Niebuhr articulated an incisive critique of the liberal Protestant social gospel and offers a salutary, if often unheeded, chastisement of the pretensions of Cold War liberalism, I also think that his mature political theology cannot provide what we need for this time. As a cleric of what Henry Luce dubbed the American century, Niebuhr quite deliberately intended to lower our expectations of political agency, to smother the fires of the era's incendiary political hopes, to constrict and even abort the political imagination, and to inhibit the enlargement of political possibility. But as that American century is, I think, entering the climacteric of its descent and demise, Niebuhr's work offers little but a snare, an impediment, to the work of political imagination and renaissance on which I think we have to embark in the coming decades. Niebuhr opened his political career as a Protestant firebrand, inveighing against liberal judiciousness and lethargy. It's become almost impossible for us to imagine now that Niebuhr, apart from the unsentimental and at times cynical political intelligence of moral man and immoral society. But it's worth recalling that during the previous decade and a half, as the pastor of Detroit's Bethel Evangelical Church, he had been one of the bright young hopes of the social gospel, eagerly rattling the teacups in the vicarage of liberal Protestant rectitude. Both religious and secular liberals had become tiresome bores in Niebuhr's anything but humble opinion. In a letter to the New Republic published in the summer of 1919, Niebuhr lamented what he called liberalism's, and these are his words, gray spirit of compromise. Provided with an auspicious moment for social reconstruction in the aftermath of World War I, liberals, he charged, balked at the opportunity to, quote, tear down old houses and build new ones. Liberals lacked fervency, in his words, that, quote, spirit of enthusiasm, not to say fanaticism, which is so necessary to move the world out of its beaten tracks. Once the vehicle of youthful political exuberance, liberalism was now, Niebuhr mocked, quote, a philosophy of the middle-aged. Those brazen high spirits animated Niebuhr's pastorage of Bethel Evangelical. They galvanized his rarely cited campaign against the Ku Klux Klan, his criticism not only of Henry Ford, but of Fordist management and mechanization, and his support for the city's labor unions, to the point not only of joining them on picket lines, but of granting organizers access to his pulpit. This is the Niebuhr who embraced pacifism, served as national chairman of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and joined other liberal Protestants such as Kirby Page, Sherwood Eddy, and Harry Ward in advocating socialism. Long after Niebuhr moved to New York in 1928 and assumed his post at Union Theological Seminary, the radical enthusiasm and critical edge that marked his letter to the New Republic remained. Niebuhr's embrace of Marxism, together with his enlistment in the more militant wing of the Socialist Party, testifies to the persistence of his radical bravado. Yet his disdain for liberal Protestantism is so palpable in Moral Man that it's easy to forget that, as Niebuhr asserts plainly in the introduction to that book, the ultimate purpose of the volume was to, quote, find political methods which will offer the most promise of achieving an ethical goal for society, an objective inflected more by Protestant moralism than by Marxist dialectic. We should keep in mind that Niebuhr's excoriation of pacifism in Moral Man appears in the midst of a reflection on, quote, religious resources for social and political transformation. Likewise, his moral equivalence of violent and nonviolent coercion, however dubious or incisive we may consider it, was intended to clarify the issues at stake, not to, quote, lame the nerve of action, as he put it later in Reflections on the End of an Era. Even though he left the Fellowship of Reconciliation in 1934, Niebuhr helped to found the Fellowship of Socialist Christians in 1931 and remained a member well into the 1940s. Niebuhr was even generous enough to write in Moral Man that modern communism is, quote, a secularized but still essentially religious version of the classical religious dream. Now, Niebuhr's invocation of dreams there would seem incongruous in a volume considered an ortext of realism. But I've come to think that if there's any enduring and unassailable insight in Moral Man, it lies neither in its indictment of pacifism, nor in its discussion of nonviolent resistance, nor in what the historian Christopher Lash, enlisting Niebuhr's words, praised as its armature for what he called a spiritual discipline against resentment, but rather in the passages on illusion and myth. In other words, the realm of political imagination, as David Graeber might remind us today. Myth was a salient topic among American intellectuals in the 1930s. Witness Kenneth Burke's call for a revolutionary symbolism, John Dewey's search for a common faith, C.L.R. James' ruminations on the cultic quality of mass entertainment, or Thurman Arnold's sardonic examination of the folklore or spiritual government of capitalism. Anticipating all of them, as well as echoing George Sorel, Niebuhr's moral and political psychology in Moral Man emphasizes not rationality or interest, but imagination. Human beings, Niebuhr mused, are, quote, governed more by imagination than by reason, and imagination is compounded of mind and impulse. Especially when it assumes political form, imagination invents what Niebuhr calls illusions, which Niebuhr defines not as fantasies, but rather as enacted fictions, something one, quote, believes to be true and is not wholly true, but ought to be true, and may become true if its truth is not doubted. Something like the imagination of Samuel Taylor Coleridge or Wallace Stevens. Illusion would seem to be a way in which we discern some genuine possibility in reality that is unseen with the eyes of rationality. Our action based on that vision, and vision is of something, which is why a visionary is someone who sees, can bring that gestating reality to birth. That is what Niebuhr appears to mean when he writes that, quote, the truest visions of religion are illusions. It's also worth recalling that Moral Man ends on a note of intoxication rather than sobriety. I want to quote this at length. The most effective agents will be men who have substituted some new illusions for the abandoned ones. The most important of these illusions is that the collective life of mankind can achieve perfect justice. It is a very valuable illusion for the moment, for justice cannot be approximated if the hope of its perfect realization does not generate a sublime madness in the soul. That's Niebuhr. Nothing but such madness will do battle with malignant power and spiritual wickedness in high places. The illusion is dangerous because it encourages terrible fanaticisms. It must therefore be brought under the control of reason. One can only hope that reason will not destroy it before its work is done, which is maybe the rest of Niebuhr's career. If, as the saying goes, one governs in prose, Niebuhr was well aware that one revolts as well as campaigns in poetry. Niebuhr's account of the promise and perversity of imagination leavened his later work as well, especially The Irony of American History. That's the one book that Niebuhr's that historians read. That's about it, I have to say. But To be sure, this book was Niebuhr's quintessential statement of a gray-flanneled Cold War liberalism. Indeed, it elevated and assured his stature among the clerics of the post-war intellectual and political establishment. But it also extends the analysis of illusion he crafted as a Protestant socialist, from the terrain of class warfare to the topography of American nationalism. Though adamant in his conviction that American power and resolve were the only realistic bulwarks against the Soviet Union and revolutionary socialism, Niebuhr was equally insistent that the nation's most pernicious illusion was its sense of exceptionalism, its conviction of providential anointment, and its delusional belief in its historical innocence. Like his friend Perry Miller, the great scholar of American Puritanism, Niebuhr observed with profound ambivalence that, quote, from the earliest days of its history to the present moment, there is a deep layer of messianic consciousness in the mind of America. In Niebuhr's view, the mythology of exceptionalism underlay the American identification of material success with virtue and divine favor, and energized its Promethean effort to be, quote, the master of destiny at home and abroad. Well, the master of destiny was now armed with a nuclear arsenal, and so the United States could no longer, in his view, afford to subscribe to this farrago of what he called sentimentalities and pretensions. One consequence of the exceptionalist delusion, about which Niebuhr was especially prescient, was the use of economic growth to evade rather than resolve social conflict. What Elizabeth Cohen has dubbed the post-war consumer's republic grew in part, in Niebuhr's view, from the exceptionalist dependence on capitalist prosperity as a sign of national anointment. Quote, every ethical and social problem of a just distribution of the privileges of life is solved by so enlarging the privileges that either an equitable distribution is made easier or a lack of equity is rendered less noticeable. I give you Keynesian economics. The ever-escalating expansion of productivity and consumption in order to pacify class conflict was by the 1950s a staple of liberal social thought and politics, a hope ballasted by the apparent stability provided by the New Deal order, the hegemony of Keynesian economics among intellectuals, and the unprecedented material abundance and technological innovation that marked what historians have called the golden age of capitalism. Niebuhr was one of the few liberal thinkers who suspected that the golden age might be short-lived. Quote, this expansion cannot go on forever, he warned, and ultimately we must face some vexatious issues of social justice in terms which will not differ too greatly from those which the nations of Europe have been forced to use. In other words, America would discover that the vices and antagonisms it thought it had left behind in Europe would not so much return as make their presence known, with an unsettling and potentially explosive rudeness. Indeed, even the social mobility that had been a fixture of American mythology would wither as economic sclerosis set in. As Niebuhr predicted ruefully when he wrote that, quote, the American class structure will become more fixated as the nation moves toward the final limits of an expanding economy. I don't think I need to comment on that. Niebuhr could be just as far-seeing about the trajectory of containment, the diplomatic and military analog to the suppression of class conflict through prosperity. And he aimed his most acerbic critique of Cold War policy at the horrific folly of the war in Vietnam. The global extension of American power had entangled, as he recognized, in, quote, a vast web of history in which other peoples, running in oblique or contrasting directions to our own, inevitably hinder or contradict what we most fervently desire. Yet because the U.S. had so little experience navigating what he called the endlessly complex compounds of loyalties, traditions, military strength, and ideological hopes, Niebuhr feared, and here I think he anticipated the insight of Graham Greene in The Quiet American, whose narrator said of his young CIA friend that, quote, he had never met a man who had better motives for all the trouble he caused. Niebuhr saw that the nation, quote, would move with one direct leap from the use of economic to the use of military power. When the U.S. did precisely this in Vietnam, Niebuhr took to the pages of the New Republic in January 1966 to declare that the war was, quote, an impossible military and moral dilemma, and that the Johnson administration should desist from escalating American involvement. Niebuhr's admonition would seem to confirm not only his reputation as a steely-eyed sage, but the stature of Christian realism as a template for politics and a bridle on American hubris. Niebuhr warned that however righteous American opposition to communism, the United States must restrain its own aspiration to master history. Acting, so this tale goes, as a prophet to the national security state, Niebuhr urged American leaders to cultivate a sense of irony, an appreciation of unintended consequences, and a capacity to identify the self-interest hidden under the noblest professions of selflessness. Suspicious of idealism of any kind, Niebuhr insisted that politicians seek limited, proximate goals, not the grandiose and utopian objectives pursued by empires and revolutionaries. Such ideals always represented, in his view, an impossible and dangerous transposition to groups of standards appropriate to individuals. Quote, it is not within the realm of moral possibility to ask a nation to be self-sacrificing. Thus, according to Christian realism, the inevitable clashes of self-interested groups could be tempered, but never eliminated. And peace could be achieved through the alignment of interest with interest, not a larger transformation of heart. By the same token, since idealism could both inflate one's own sense of righteousness and demonize one's opponents, realism about group self-interest would diminish rather than encourage violence. Niebuhr counseled humility, irony, and realism in part out of an eschatological modesty, a reticence that rendered foolish any blueprint or schedule of history's consummation. Writing in the frostiest days of the Cold War, Niebuhr feared that Americans, quote, lack the humility to accept the fact that the whole drama of history is enacted in a frame of meaning too large for human comprehension or management. Similarly, Niebuhr's opposition to pacifism stemmed from a particular political ontology. Like imperialists and revolutionaries, pacifists, Niebuhr thought, were naive in their conviction that ideals could be enacted within the turbulent contingencies of history. When David Dellinger and other pacifist students at Union were expelled in 1940 for refusing to register for the draft, Niebuhr preached a sermon condemning not their lack of patriotism, but what he termed their arrogance. Putting the wisdom of serpents before the gentleness of doves, Niebuhr's realism could both sanction intimidation, violence, and deceit, and enjoin Christians to beg forgiveness for the commission of these necessary evils, because it refused to grant any political significance to love. Speaking especially to religious pacifists, Niebuhr asserted in the first volume of The Nature and Destiny of Man that, quote, the law of love stands on the edge of history, not in history. It presents an ultimate and not an immediate possibility. For Niebuhr here, time is relentlessly unilinear. We have no access to the fullness of love that awaits us at the end of history. Love's appearance in our time could only be partial at best. Agape must always defer to realpolitik. As Bertolt Brecht once put it, those who preached kindness could not themselves be kind. Both Niebuhr's political ontology and his eschatology rest on a purely secular temporality, the imminent frame, as Charles Taylor has called it, empty homogeneous time, in Walter Benjamin's words, plodding and unredemptive, in which love will have to remain until the end of, will have to wait until the end of history, when all obstacles to its sway have disappeared. Until then, politics can only be, at best, an unending and often violent vocation in the dirty business of damage control. This is the Niebuhr who continues to exercise a spell over politicians and intellectuals. From presidents, Jimmy Carter and Barack Obama both cited him as a major influence, to philosophers, theologians, and historians, Paul Ramsey, Jean Bethke Elstein, Richard John Neuhaus, and Andrew Bacevich, the latter Niebuhr's most able and sensitive contemporary acolyte. Yet the fact that such a spectrum could invoke Niebuhr should elicit not marvel at his bipartisan appeal, but rather suspicion of his bipartisan appeal. Just as, by the way, we should always be suspicious of anything bipartisan. Head for the hills. A great evil is about to be perpetrated on the Republic when you hear this word. Aside from Basevich, perhaps, the Niebuhrians I just cited have comprised a roster of faithful imperial stewardship, willing and even eager to justify the most horrendous and inept of imperial crusades. So as sympathetic as I am to Niebuhrian appeals for greater modesty and self-restraint, I'm doubtful that Christian realism can really moderate or constrain imperial ambition. In his laudable eagerness to find historical precursors for his own critiques of empire, Basevich overlooked some real and intractable problems with his hero's work. Niebuhr adopted a fundamentally contradictory stance during the Cold War, for instance. Contain American illusions of innocence and omnipotence, yet at the same time endorse a realistic posture against communism that entailed both the possible use of nuclear weapons and the repression of post-colonial revolutionary movements. Despite his imprecations against the reckless pride of American globalism, Niebuhr's conception of Cold War international politics as a never-ending conflict in which the children of light would have to employ the weapons of the children of darkness made it difficult for him to oppose anything the United States did. Niebuhr himself realized that calls for humility and circumspection were perfectly compatible with global dominion. Writing in Luce's Life magazine in September 1948, Niebuhr mused that, quote, we will have to stand at every point of our far-flung lines. Sounds like an empire to me. Later, noting in the irony of American history that Egyptian and Mesopotamian city-states were, quote, responsible for the order and cohesion of these first great empires in human history. Niebuhr opined that, quote, the preponderant power of America may have a similar role to play in the present international scene. Recall that Niebuhr advised U.S. leaders to halt their escalation of the war in Vietnam. He did not call for a withdrawal of combat forces. This was not, I think, a mere default of logic. It was more fundamentally a default of imagination, a capitulation to the canons of reason enunciated by the military-industrial leviathan of the post-war corporate commonwealth. Niebuhr's demurral on Vietnam was indicative of his habitual deference to the ideological and political parameters of the Cold War establishment, of which he was a charter member. Niebuhr could not and never did see how the debacle in Vietnam stemmed from the very notions of communist malevolence and American indispensability that he shared with other liberal intellectuals, politicians, and policymakers. Like his fellow Cold Warriors, Niebuhr never really questioned the tenets of Wilsonian liberal internationalism, itself a progeny of that very messianic impulse that Niebuhr otherwise knew to be a source of fanaticism. We and the rest of the world are still paying the price for American denial of and inattention to the intractable realities of the post-colonial world that was emerging in the wake of the Versailles Treaty and the end of the Second World War. At the same time, and by the same token, Niebuhr could not endorse a more radical reorganization of American society because he shared with liberals a truncated sense of possibility, acquiescing in their circumscribed account of what was realistic. He and other liberal intellectuals counseled either resignation to malignant power or a decent modesty in its reform, anything but a sublime madness that he now castigated as either ineffectual or murderous. His abandonment of any meaningful socialist politics was bound up with an overvaluation of expertise, a techno-managerial inclination endemic, I would contend, both to the liberal Protestant social gospel and to the entire progressive liberal lineage of American social and political thought, from John Dewey and Thorsten Veblen to Daniel Bell, John Kenneth Galbraith, and Cass Sunstein. To be fair, Niebuhr was no technocratic ideologue. In the irony of American history, for instance, he warns against America's, quote, cult of technical efficiency and insists that, quote, we are more desperately in need of genuine charity than of more technocratic skills. Yet an inclination toward managerialist politics was evident in Niebuhr's own writing as early as the 1920s, but it surfaced most clearly during the Second World War. In The Children of Light and The Children of Darkness, Niebuhr redefines socialism, not as the resolution of what he politely dubs the property issue. Yeah, there's that property issue. The resolution of that issue through workers' control of production, but rather as the achievement of abundance and efficiency through benevolent managerial prowess. The modern economic order required, he now thought, quote, the best possible distribution of power for the sake of justice and the least possible management for the sake of order. A management provided precisely by a professional class supposedly insulated from the imperatives of capital. This was the ideology of the end of ideology, as it was proclaimed by Daniel Bell in 1960, and it's the exemplary Cold War restatement of the technocratic political imagination. Niebuhr also defaulted on the racial front, endorsing the small step strategy of white liberals that Martin Luther King Jr. would later dismiss as, quote, the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Niebuhr's reluctance to support the newly combative civil rights movement was sadly ironic, as it belied his prescient speculation in Moral Man, based on his observations of Gandhi's successes in South Africa and India, that, quote, there is no problem of political life to which a religious imagination can make a larger contribution than this problem of developing nonviolent resistance. Yet when confronted with so glorious a confirmation, Niebuhr retreated into equivocation. The Brown decision in 1954 satisfied Niebuhr that America's racial divisions, quote, were on the way of being resolved. Yeah, almost got that done. Because, in words that sound positively Deweyan in their optimism, he credited, quote, the general tendency of increasing social intelligence to withdraw its support from the claims of social privilege. Uh-huh. Yet Niebuhr expressed sympathy with Southern white parents who feared a decline in the educational standards of integrated schools, citing, and these are Niebuhr's words, cultural differences between the races. Later, responding to the Montgomery boycotts, Niebuhr went absolutely Burkean, invoking hoary conservative chestnuts about organic processes in an effort to convince King and other leaders of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to check the movement's momentum. It was, quote, politically unwise to advocate gradualism, but it was, in his view, morally wise to practice it. The socialist firebrand of 1919 had become a crashing middle-class bore. Thus, it's hard to see how a thinker whom the journalist Richard Rovere once anointed the official establishment theologian in 1960 could pose much of a threat to, well, the official establishment. His realism dovetailed well with the sonorous rhetoric of maturity and responsibility that was the lingua franca among courtier intellectuals such as Arthur Schlesinger, Jr., and imperial mandarins such as McGeorge Bundy and Robert McNamara. As Niebuhr's biographer Richard Fox has observed, Niebuhr enabled such men to, quote, maintain faith in themselves as political actors in a troubled, what he termed, sinful world. Niebuhr taught that moral men had to play hardball. Covering themselves with guilt in order to fulfill some high responsibility, these are Fox's words, cold warriors could ravage Vietnam and other nations, recalling Niebuhr's solemn benediction on, quote, conscious choices of evil for the sake of good. Pontius Pilate couldn't have said it better. Despite his chastisement of American hubris, Niebuhr was no prophet to the establishment, as Henry May once dubbed him. A rueful theologian of empire, Niebuhr was a pontifex maximus for Cold War elites, among whom Christian realism offered an ideological sanction for U.S. foreign and military policy. Even if we set aside Niebuhr's reverential enlistment by the Cold War elite, his account of moral and political life is open to serious challenge. Although Niebuhr hoped that Christian realism would chasten ambition and civilize conflict, it's hard to see how it could ever do either, given Niebuhr's well-known pessimism about groups. His dismissal of the notion that nations could be self-sacrificing leads inexorably to a sense of futility, since the acute and profound consciousness of the capacity for sin that is central to Christian realism would have to be cultivated by a people. not only by an introspective elite, itself a laughable notion. It would demand a talent for contemplation and humility that would presumably constrain their inclination to self-delusion, vengeance, and malice. Yet Niebuhr himself observed that no political community in history has ever possessed this talent, at least not in any abundance. And it is especially difficult talent to develop as among Americans, the identity of that community is inseparable from a conviction of errand, destiny, providence, or century. As so often happens in his work, Niebuhr intensifies the consciousness of sin, yet offers little but rumination on the tragedy of it all. Those unwilling to make the future a hostage to tragedy must either hope that the virtues indispensable for Christian realism can be nurtured among an elite, and the track record on that score is not encouraging, or forthrightly dispute the terms of Niebuhr's pessimism. They would therefore have to contend with Niebuhr's insistence on realism, the feature of his political thinking that is usually considered most unassailable, but which I would suggest is in fact quite dubious and contestable. Realism, like other words such as pragmatic, efficient, responsible, and serious, always watch out for these words. Realism has always been a formidable weapon in the rhetorical arsenal of power, indispensable for clearing and protecting the moral and epistemological high ground. Any challenge to Niebuhrian realpolitik must begin not by sending a banal and ineffectual idealism into battle, but by exposing the fraudulence of many a hard-boiled claim to realism. Christian realists too readily cede the power to define reality, and therefore possibility, to the professional and managerial cadres of the national security state and the corporations. Yet, as Niebuhr himself might well have agreed, realism then often turns out to be either an imprimatur on the status quo, a mere surrender to the actual, as Randolph Bourne once put it so well, or there's simply the malignant illusions of the powerful. But if realism is not what it seems, then what appears to be Niebuhr's strongest point is in fact his Achilles heel. If what often passes for realism is so thoroughly suspect, then Christian realism is but a pious version of the counterfeit veracity of power. By deferring to the cognitive and political expertise of the imperial state, Christian realists both stoke imperial desire and thus ensure their own irrelevance and obscure the range of moral and political possibility. So rather than lament the lack of hope or idealism in Niebuhr's thought, today's apostates from empire must reclaim the language of realism. They must be visionaries in the proper sense of the word, people who see what's really there, in fact and latent in possibility. It may turn out, ironically, that Niebuhrian realism paralyzes the moral and political imagination not because it is realistic, but because it is not realistic enough. The shortcomings of Christian realism were evident to A.J. Musty. That's Musty with an E at the end. Dutch Reformed minister, genuine socialist, and one of Niebuhr's keenest and most persistent critics. Today Musty is remembered primarily as an anti-war and civil rights activist, engaging in civil disobedience with Dorothy Day, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and the War Resisters League, and often literally holding a candle of peace against nuclear weapons in the Vietnam War. Musty wrote and acted on the basis of a distinctive political ontology and eschatology that challenged the realism of Christian realism. While Niebuhr was right in his view to warn that all earthly power was ultimately, quote, ephemeral, weak, and doomed, Musty believed that history contained a wider array of possibilities. Nonviolence and radical change were practical and realistic, Musty believed, because the love that Niebuhr banished to the end of history was available in the here and now. Quote, the divine is always about to break into history, shattering the ideological firmament that makes the imminent frame appear unbreachable. Against Niebuhr's secular, linear, empty, homogeneous time, Musty posed an ontological and eschatological alternative, what's sometimes called a realized eschatology. The past, he reflected, quote, does not simply grind out the future through the sieve of the present. For Musty, as for Walter Benjamin, every moment was the gate through which the Messiah could enter. The present and the future are simultaneous and permeable. The here and now is open to incursion from the kingdom. The future can interrupt and transform our time. Every act of love is a visit to the kingdom and brings the future in the present tense. In other words, as Musty put it, love can change history. Because time, having more than one direction, is always on our side. Musty conceded that love offered no greater guarantee of success than reliance on money and weapons, the arsenal of fear that provides the world with its bloody and evanescent security. The partisans of love would inevitably suffer obloquy, exile, even death. The main reason, Musty suspected, that guile and violence seemed to be safer options for Christian realists. But in the end, Musty mused, there simply is no safety in our futile efforts to secure ourselves in time. All attempts to master our fates conclude in ashes, ruin, and butchery. Nothing really belongs to us. So by accepting the vulnerability that comes with a shul of possession and violence, the pacifist is, in Musty's words, the supreme realist. However draped in the changing rhetorical fashions of liberal democratic capitalism, the American quest for imperial mastery was another vain grasp at eternity. And like that of an earlier empire, the nation's pursuit of global supremacy was a snare and a delusion. Quote, in its way, the Roman Empire was real enough, Musty once wrote. But its power structure was not permanent, not real. It was a house built on sand. For Musty, the problem lay not in the nature of groups, but in the reluctance to live without dominion. Forswearing ultimate allegiance to the principalities rooted in dust, the vanguard of the eschaton must be, in his words, loose and experimental, living as lightly tethered as possible to the world of business and empire. They might even lead their fellow citizens to a happier, if humbler, destiny. For one never knew when the other side of history would swoop in and transform the time. Quote, love can change history, Musty asserted, for, quote, love is mightier than dominion. To be sure, Musty could be no less insistent than Niebuhr on the ironies of historical action. Referring to the earliest Christians who expected the heavenly city and instead merely inherited the Roman Empire, Musty observed that, quote, what came about did not resemble their dreams. But he then mused that, quote, it never does. Corruption was mingled with the glory. But this recognition of the ineradicable ambiguity of history did not induce Musty, as it did Niebuhr, to counsel resignation to the sinful necessities of subterfuge and occasional carnage. In Musty's view, there are more things in heaven and earth that are dreamt of in realpolitik. So if, quote, reality is not what men tend to call the real, end quote, if the world is an ampler and more generous place than the faithless are compelled to make it, then love is a power and not an ideal. As Musty had written in 1940, there are in our universe resources for living the life of love which we have hardly begun to tap, but which we must learn to draw upon. Musty's conviction that a politics of love was more practical than Niebuhrian realism was shared by an array of Cold War radicals, often dubbed personalists by historians. For example, the Catholic Workers, led by Dorothy Day, the participants in several communes or intentional communities, such as Clarence Jordan's Quantania Farm, the loose coalition of secular and religious radicals who wrote for the journal Liberation, including Musty, Day, Dellinger, Baird Rustin, Dwight MacDonald, and Paul Goodman, and a host of others who prefigured a new left dissociated from Marxism and social democracy. And eventually elements of that new left itself, the partisans of beloved community who permeated the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and Students for a Democratic Society. What distinguished personalism from other forms of post-war radicalism was its double focus on personal and political renewal. Its commitment to the idea that existential metamorphosis, what Paul Tillich called the courage to be, was bound up with political transformation. Any new radicalism must begin from a faith in the possibilities of the here and now, a realized eschatology, if you will, the future in the present tense, or living the new world in the wreckage of the old. Something Reinhold Niebuhr, too sure in the serenity of the ruling elite, would not and cannot help us do. I'm clear.
This is more of a technical question, but Dr. Hausch, the opening story, the conversion story that you mentioned, can you tell us where that came from?
Yeah, it comes from Gilkey's book. It's simply called Reinhold Niebuhr.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Langdon Gilkey. I'll make an observation. It's interesting that the emphasis I put on Bonhoeffer's attempt to recover what it meant to have a visible church, that word never passed Eugene's lips in terms of characterizing Niebuhr. Mm-hmm. Because Niebuhr, and I just see what Gene... Niebuhr continued to presume the viability of mainstream Protestantism as an eternal reality. That proved, he didn't have to give an account of it, he just assumed it. And that proved to be a very doubtful presumption.
No, that's true, and I would also add that someone, a Niebuhr who did, was his brother H. Richard. In various venues, one being, I can't remember the name of the book he wrote.
Church in the World.
The Church in the World, thank you. Yeah, simple enough. In 1937, I believe. And it's remarkable what he says, because he does, in fact, see the church as some kind of a political agent in this book. And I think it's worth noting that he wrote this book after he wrote Social Sources of Denominationalism, which is sort of quintessential liberal Protestant religious sociology. Thank you. Yeah, the church doesn't come up as a political actor at all in Reinhold's political theology. I mean, it's just, it's there. It's supposed to make us, I don't want to quite say nice people, but it's supposed to encourage us to be idealistic, I guess is maybe the best way to put it. But other than that, it has no political relevance at all. Yeah.
How do you characterize, you've kind of given us Musty as a better way. How do you characterize Musty's theological vision? Like what sort of theology is enabling him to offer these political solutions?
It's hard to say, because Musty, first of all, was not at all a systematic thinker or writer. Most of what Musty wrote is in the form of essays, pamphlets, speeches at demonstrations, and so on. So he's certainly not, he drives academics crazy for this precise reason. You can't say, okay, yeah, this is what A.J. thought in terms of. So I have to confess that my exposition of Musty is perhaps more organized and systematic than he was about this. And so, yeah, there's a danger there, perhaps, of presenting Musty as being too consistent, but historians are able to do that because we don't care about that.
There was a phrase you used, though. Musty always presumed that love could break into history.
Yes.
Bonhoeffer assumed love had, and the name of that was Jesus, and that whether Musty would agree with that or not, mm-hmm. I think is not. I mean, it just didn't come up in a way.
What I will say is that Musty had an interesting religious history. I mean, in this regard, Musty you know, comes from a Dutch Reform background. He goes to New York in the early 1910s, and he becomes a liberal Protestant. Then he joins the labor movement in the 20s, and in the 30s he actually becomes a Trotskyist in the mid-30s and just loses his faith altogether. Then he has this interesting kind of conversion experience in a church in Paris, where he just, you know, he goes in and his political future looks like it's in shambles. He's been betrayed by his Trotskyist comrades, and he's just sitting there thinking, like, what the hell am I going to do now? Because I have no... And all of a sudden, he has this epiphany, right? You have to come back to the church. He says this, you have to come back to the church. And the church is the true international or something like this. I mean, look, this resonates with me as a lefty. So I do think that there's something of an ecclesiology there. It's certainly not cogent. I mean, I'll concede that. It's not coherent. But I think Musty would agree that love had entered.
Yeah, I'm sure. The question is how decisive that one entrance was for all determinations of what would to come later. Musty as a Dutch Calvinist, I always think of Peter de Vries, the great Dutch Calvinist author who was raised so enthusiastically in Dutch Calvinism because his mother thought Jesus was Dutch. So you can see there was a lot to reject there.
Right.
You, Dr. Howes, made a contention that because the church is fully human, it must resist the impulse to be pure, but in the analogous framework of the church being Christ's body in the world, if you just elaborate on that point, because that will not, I want it to be resonant, but there's a wall for me.
Yeah, purity is an ugly reality. The appropriate theological term is holiness. And holiness is something that happens to you rather than something you do. And therefore, any claim for the church's faithfulness is what God has done for the church, not what it's done. So the kind of claim that I think Bonhoeffer is making is one that suggests that God never leaves the world without a faithful witness. So that's partly what Bonhoeffer now is. As we see the devastation of what the German Lutheran Church became, we know it was wrong because we have Bonhoeffer. That's holiness in that way. These are tricky matters. But I think that purity, the critique that Bonhoeffer is really going after, it is the enemy, interestingly enough, is pietism. And pietism oftentimes identifies what it means to be Christian with moralistic presuppositions that prove not to give you the kind of power to stand against the powers. And that's what Bonhoeffer gives you. Yes?
Both of you kind of addressed
that. Can you speak up a little?
Yeah.
Sure.
for the old man who's hard of hearing.
Sure. Both of you kind of addressed Niebuhr's activity as a pastor. I'm wondering if one or both of you could speak to kind of your understanding of what promoted the transformation in his thinking between his activity in Detroit and then his activity in being theological. Was that better?
Yes, thank you.
Well, first of all, his mother made his pastorate possible. I mean, she was always around. Indeed, after he married Ursula, they weren't quite sure what to do with mother. But Niebuhr, while he was certainly a good pastor, leaves from the Notebook of a Tame Cynic is a wonderful read. Where, I mean, he talks about the reason that pastors seldom preach the truth is not because they're afraid of losing their income, but because it's so hard to tell people you've learned to love the truth. I mean, Niebuhr is filled with those kinds of insights that make us want to think he's right about most things. Which is a mistake. But Niebuhr at Detroit and then later, he's an evangelist. He's all over the damn world giving one talk after the other, one sermon after the other. So I don't think he didn't have much to do with what you might think of as building up a local community.
This is going to sound cynical, and maybe it is partly, but I also think it's just a historical explanation. Niebuhr was always, I don't want to say a social climber, but I do think that Niebuhr was a guy who was looking to get out of Detroit. I think he was a guy who, once he got to New York, hey, this is my milieu. Here I am. I'm hanging out with intellectuals. I'm hanging out with people who write for the New Republic, the Nation, the New Masses. I mean, hey, these are my people. He's hanging out with labor organizers, communist, socialist party members. I mean, it's not like he didn't meet these people in Detroit, but they're in New York. I mean, my God, this is the epicenter of the American left. In the 1930s. And so that's why I say I'm not being entirely cynical about that, because I think that Niebuhr just felt that Detroit wasn't a big enough stage. And I arguably think, it wasn't. Right?
When his first language was German, and so he didn't write English very well at all. When you read his MA thesis that he did at Yale, I mean, it's just filled with misspellings and so on. And I mean, it reminded me of me. And there was always a kind of social inferiority that I think that he struggled with. His relationship with Van Dusen, the guy that became president of Union, who was high class. I mean, that was a very tense relationship, I think, because of that.
As simplistic as it may sound, what would your critique be of why Niebuhr seems still relevant to public figures and politicians? I mean, you talked about how Carter and Obama, quote, recite him. Why people that I think of in higher terms, why would they reflect on him and use him as somebody?
Well, part of my answer would be maybe you should stop thinking of them in such high terms, especially Obama, who I think has been vastly overpraised.
Niebuhr, you don't like Larry Summers.
Pardon?
You don't like Larry Summers.
Well, no. Whoever he was with, Larry Summers. Niebuhr tells you, Niebuhr, if you're powerful, Niebuhr tells you what you want to hear, which is you have to do many things that are nasty, But you can still be a relatively decent person if you cry enough about the fact that you have to do nasty things. I know that sounds cynical, but I think that is what his appeal is to politicians.
Carter, I mean, to go back on that, Jimmy
yeah.
Carter is somebody, I think, who has really wrestled with his conscience as a man of conscience and faith, but also as a president. And I think he did unpopular things when he was a president that clearly, I mean, to have people say he's the most popular ex-president there ever was, you know, but he's someone who I think still tries and works with his faith. I mean, still teaches Sunday school. So here's somebody who I think really is actively engaged with his faith and his conscience.
In Carter's case, I mean, about which I have to say I know less than in Obama's, but in Carter's case, I think, and maybe this is also true for a lot of American politicians, that they think they know about Reinhold Niebuhr. Right, so what you get is a mythology of Reinhold Niebuhr. Right, he's Mr. Serious. He's guy with stroke chin, furrow brow. Yes, we think deeply about political matters and serious matters. You know, and this. And so I think what happens is the guys like Carter. I mean, I don't know how much Carter's read Reinhold Niebuhr, so I'll say that right up front. I think that what they do is they invoke this Reinhold Niebuhr, right? In the same way that people talk about Picasso, right? But they know very little about Picasso. But they like Picasso because, hey, everybody else has been telling me I should like Picasso, right? I think that's the same way a lot of people think about Niebuhr.
I think at a deeper level, it relates to a word that Gene used early on, and that's stoicism. I think Niebuhr is a form of Christian stoicism. And the Stoics was a perfect positioning for bureaucrats of an empire who weren't going to be able to do very much about empire, but they had to make do with what they had. That's called fate. And I think that Niebuhrianism is a kind of stoicism in the American empire that is very appealing. I think that Gene's right, though, that Niebuhr is a legitimating name that you can use to suggest that you've thought about things more deeply than in fact you have.
Witness David Brooks using it.
How do we bring that down a bit? You know, how do we take, you know, this, like you said, this, you know, and bring it, maybe showing that he has played deep?
Have us talk at campuses more, maybe. I mean, I don't know. It'll be difficult because, God, I mean, he still gets invoked, what, almost 50 years after his death. So it's a hard struggle to try to do that. Yeah.
So I'd be interested in hearing you both reflect a little bit more on this idea that you brought up in the end of your lecture on the idea of, like, being more realist than this Christian realism. Especially, it makes me think in a lot of my reading of Niebuhr, one of the things that seems true is that he makes moral calculations, but you almost get the sense that when he makes them, he can't even, like, he has this robust picture of sin and pride, but he almost can't see them sort of at work in his own thinking about them. And it seems to me that sort of failure to be realistic about your own blindness, or in some cases you might just say apathy, or lead to a moral calculation that can say, well, you know, Vietnam, you know, it's, that's something, you know, we can just sort of ask for forgiveness later. But then actively critique something like the civil rights movement, or as James Cone has written out really well, I think, have total blindness to things like lynchings, and total unblindness to speak out about those kinds of things. So I'd be interested in hearing, probably bring you both, actually, about I'll just put my card on the table. What a leftist sort of Christian realism look like in that way?
Well, part of it you already began to articulate, yeah, so yeah. Bravo. Simply, well, knowing your history, which I think Niebuhr actually didn't know too well, as much as he invokes it. You know, history with a capital H, I think, becomes for Niebuhr, it becomes a wand with which to conjure. So, once again, if I talk about history with enough gravitas, then people will take what I'm saying seriously. Part of me wants to say that, hey, this is like good old Marxist class position, right? I mean, once you're in there and you're having lunch with George Kennan and you're being interviewed by the policy planning staff, what do you expect, right? I mean, it's hard for me to imagine A.J. Musty being invited, to testify before the Senate Armed Services Committee, I mean, as Niebuhr was.
Never trust anyone who makes humility a central virtue.
And writes books about it with their name on the title page.
Because humility is a correlative of being humiliated. And Niebuhr was not humiliated, but he made humility his stance that meant that his views were more determinative than your views because he represented the position of humility.
See how humble I am.
It's just simply there. I'm committed to Christian nonviolence. I think it's a hell of a lot more realistic viewpoint than those that think they're going to control violence through the Pentagon. I mean, really? For example, my realism, when the first Iraqi war broke out, before it broke out, I suggested that we give every Iraqi $1 million. I thought that that was a realistic alternative because you're going to spend that much anyway. Just turn them into bourgeois consumers.
This is what Andrew Bacevich said.
That was
his suggestion.
He must have stole it from me.
I'm
an admirer of Bacevich, by the way. I mean, he's one of the more honest, military-minded people we have. So I think, realism is just a grease pig. And so, if you're going to, everyone's going to claim it because it sounds like a rah-rah word. But I don't know that it's that helpful, because it so quickly turns into an ideology.
You both hit on pacifism and Christian nonviolence. I'm curious, in your book, Dr. McCarrie, you talk about this kind of golden age, like in the 30s with Dorothy Day and personalists. It seemed, and then you have Martin Luther King Jr. coming out of that. I'm just curious, like, what's happened to that sort of public Christian nonviolence? I think, Dr. Hauerwas, you're probably the most visible, that's still reputable out there. And I'm just curious, why is this not an option anymore?
Well, it is. I didn't want to be a pacifist, but I am. So it's still an option. I think people think it's, quote, unrealistic, and it's too idealistic. My way of putting it, though, is that Christians are called to be nonviolent, not because we think nonviolence is a strategy to rid the world of war, though we want to make war less likely, for sure. But in a world of war, as faithful followers of Christ, we cannot imagine being anything other than nonviolent. So there is a demand about truthfulness that is part and parcel of that position that doesn't come easy. You know, I mean, look, I'm obviously a violent son of a bitch. I'm a Texan.
You are, that's right.
It's not like, oh, I know what nonviolence is. I'm going to be able. Let me show you. But by saying, by telling you that I'm committed to nonviolence, you may have all kinds of different views about what that means. But I have some hope by creating expectations in you about what I'm supposed to be. You will keep me faithful to what I know is true. So nonviolence is a requires a community of trust that most people don't think exist. But I do. I think they're called friends.
In kind of a similar vein to that question, how does nonviolence then not become inaction? Because I think one of the things I really appreciate about Reinhold Niebuhr is the willingness and sort of reckless willingness to speak with specificity about how one would act, and I think that's why the personalists are great examples. And I'm very frustrated with the language of love and the power of love today.
Good.
In that it becomes acquiescent.
Yeah, I don't use the language. The only name I'll give you in response is Martin Luther King. That's I mean, he did it.
All right, this is where I maybe differ a bit with my table mate here. I think we should use the language of love. First of all, because we haven't used it in a long time. Secondly, because it would jar the ears of those who haven't heard it, and then might make them inquisitive about what is this thing called love that you talk about so much. And I think that one of the reasons I chose Musty is that Musty himself was just as politically active as Niebuhr, simply not with the same people, right? Like I said, I can't imagine Musty hanging out with George Kennan, but Musty hung out with Martin Luther King, I mean, with Bayard Rustin, with a whole lot of disreputable people in the 50s and 60s. That's political organization. It's slow, it's hard. It doesn't always get the New York Times to cover you, but eventually it will. I guess I'd put more emphasis on, yeah, the New York Times is going to cover you. That can be a double-edged sword.
Right. I'm a friend named Ernesto Cortez, who is a head of the Texas Industrial Areas Foundation, which if you want slow politics, it's slow politics, but it's real politics. And of course, that's where Obama came from, was community organizing. And Ernie said to me once, terrible organizer, maybe better president, which indicated that where he thought real politics occurred.
I'm sorry. I just want to say one more thing. I guess I'm also a little bit more optimistic, and that's not saying a hell of a lot, about the possibilities of remaking maybe the left wing of the Democratic Party. Now, notice I said remaking, because there is not one now, right? I even think talking about the left anymore is talking about a chimera. I mean, I'm not even sure there is one. But again, I think this is something you make, right? And if it's not there, you make it.
Okay, we are getting into it now, and I know this question is going to.
So I guess my question is stemming from please over this reference for Luther, but also a desire to to contextualize the work that MLK does as made possible in part by movements like Malcolm X and these ones that invoke a certain bit of violence, and then similarly with what's happened recently and this work of community organizing that's almost, you know, that invokes a sense of love and is in a sense self-congratulatory and it's a sense of unity as a form of erasure, but also stepping on the back of the work that the Antifa is doing as they're taking responsibility or reacting in a perhaps violent way, that these two things exist at the same time and they're necessary to each other. And to kind of position yourself as a pacifist is interesting because in a way it gets to step on the back of the people doing the sufficient life work.
When one of the criticisms of MLK early on was Niebuhrian, in that his nonviolent campaigns only worked because of the background threat of violence.
That was Clarence Jordan's critique.
I'm sorry?
That was Clarence Jordan's critique.
And King adamantly refused that description. The answer, I suppose that, I mean, what he constantly was thinking, he learned about Gandhi through Philip Randolph, and he was, Gandhi in the Great Salt Strike, when some of his followers started to respond to police brutality with brutality, he called it off. He said, "We're not ready." And I think Martin Luther King would have had that same reaction, because he was, I mean, nonviolence wasn't a strategy to get things done, though it certainly had that effect, but it was a way of life that was necessary to have your enemy have the possibility of redemption. Now that's a hell of a project, but that was Martin Luther King.
My only, I'm still trying to think this kind of thing through. I sort of have the critique of some elements of Antifa that Chomsky has, which is in effect that you're just begging for the state to crack down on you when you're using violence, because you're giving them an excuse. And once they crack down on you, once they crack down on violent Antifa, you're next. I mean, my feeling is, look, don't give the state whatever opportunity you want to crack down on, or any opportunity they want to crack down on you. Stay out of jail if you can. I mean, I don't see any particular virtue in being jailed. Just as Jesus had no particular desire, as far as I understand, to be crucified. Please crucify me. I'm not sure if that's speaking quite to your question. Maybe I'm not quite understanding your question.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know that I don't know that I see that Antifa in their contemporary substantiation as begging for state.
No, I'm not saying they are begging. I'm saying in effect, there's a sense in which Chomsky's right in saying it's like you're almost begging to get cracked down on.
What
could be said of any protest?
Well, I know. They see that's why I'm still trying to think these things through, because I know that can be said right of any group.
I think
resists.
Nonviolence requires one of the categories that Gene was using from Niebuhr: imagination. And it means that you have to find ways of befuddling those that would control you. I mean, for example, in 1968, I think, when the Chicago Convention of Hubert Humphrey, we had the police riots there because, you know, and they beat up the so-called 60s radicals and that kind of, people said, we need to send the police back to school where they will be educated to have more sympathy with these kids and so on. I said, that takes too long. Let's put them in clown uniforms with funny hats from England. And when a kid comes up and say, you fascist son of a bitch, how could you say that of a clown? So,
clowns are scary.
I'm sorry?
Clowns are scary.
Clowns can be very scary. But it's just a way to try to think. There are other strategies.
The other strategy may be the interventions of anarchists and anti-fascists in situations where...
Sure.
The police and the representatives of state power are standing back and looking on with this kind of spectatorial indifference. And the only buffer between the demonstration and mass violence is the kind of play and theatrical, but I think quite courageous interventions of, I'm speaking of Charlottesville,
right,
of the anti-fascist and anarchists. I mean, Cornel West was absolutely right that had they not been on site playing this particular role, there would have been greater injury, death. There is a kind of, I mean, I would think that you would kind of appreciate the kind of prankster kind of elasticity, the sort of playfulness, the anonymity. They're not dressed up like clowns, but there is a kind of theatrical quality to the an unscripted quality to the role played by anarchists and anti-fascists.
Right.
In this particular situation.
Which I think has always been one of the great strengths of the anarchist tradition, to try to dramatize, or in this case, comedize, what's an inherent, both at once an inherently repressive, but also absurd, right, condition where it's very clear that the state is taking the side of fascists. that's one instance, I think, where this is somewhat different from the 60s, where, you know, it's you didn't have a bunch of fascists running around in the 1960s, and the cops were clearly taking their side. I mean, this in some sense makes the state's complicity in this kind of thing all the more clear than it was in the 60s. I mean, at least the 60s, they could make some kind of a claim, however bogus. Well, we're just, you know, maintaining law and order. Well, that's not what you're doing here. You are clearly you are encouraging disorder.
Yeah,
you know,
what fascists can't stand though is to be laughed at. and they'll kill you in a minute. And I'm far theatrical display, but it's dangerous shit.
Sure.
It's another instance where I think I'm sorry. It's another one of these instances where I think once again Niebuhr's default in this regard was telling that, you know, there's that statement in Moral Man where he says, you know, he's looking at Gandhi and he's saying, boy, you know, this is really a frontier where we can develop strategies of nonviolence. Yeah, well, here's another one.
He says also in Moral Man, if a season of violence will achieve limited justice, there is nothing that can be said against it. Mm. If a season of violence, what a phrase. Mm.
Just on the absurdity as a tool for anti-fascists, I don't think we're working with a different toolbox than people with different ideologies from us. The KKK was set up with their costumes and their names of wizards and cyclops to be dismissed so that when they did conduct all of their actions, they were seen as goofy clowns and not actual evil forces in the world. Same with the issue of free speech that is currently being tossed around as the banner that the alt-right's uniting under. It's not a different pool of resources that they're pulling from than the things that we believe in necessarily. So I just took two of them.
Well,
Stanley, you had some thoughts about the free speech.
Oh, I think the whole discussion around we want to have protect free speech is absolute bullshit. Marketplace of ideas, what stupidity! I mean, that's Hyde Park Corner. You can say anything you want to on Hyde Park Corner because it doesn't mean a damn thing to anybody. I mean, any speech that is free is going to cost you something. And so you've got to be able to name the specificity of what is happening in terms of why certain kinds of speech is not to be legitimated. And you say why? You can't use the N-word because of the history of racism that we've had. You say why it is that certain kinds of speech is to be limited, why it cannot be used. Free speech as just, we must let everyone say what they want to say, where and then we can make up our minds. That's a community that no longer has any convictions at all, other than it has no convictions at all.
I have a question. Mentioned in Niebuhr's writings, there's kind of the absence of or marginalization of the church. It's not present in Niebuhr's writings. And then Bonhoeffer, especially in your essay, is the churchman who seeks ordination and stays within it.
Yeah.
And you speak at the beginning about the disastrous distinction between theology proper and practical or pastoral theology that seems really pervasive in the U.S. and from my perspective. And I'm curious how you would speak to what we can learn from Bonhoeffer and how to reconcile those things or bring them together within the context of local churches what it looks like to try to bridge that.
Well, congregations no longer expect ministers to preach the truth. They want them to be pastoral presence, to tell their children what they are afraid their children might think about doing, but they are already doing. And so it is always a kind of pastoral, you know, their presence that legitimates the ministry today in terms of being someone that is sympathetic, kind, and hasn't had too many divorces and remarriages. How to recover a sense of calling for people in the ministry to understand that theology matters is going to be a great struggle. Just at the time that the Protestant mainstream is in the process of dying. But then that's not bad because you haven't got anything to lose. If you're dying, I mean, you're free. Isn't that wonderful? I think that it's not without hope in this. I mean, you know, God seems to be making the church leaner and meaner, and that's possibly a very good thing. That partly, I say people forget that the beginnings of the Christian social engagement was with, as Jean mentioned, the social gospel. And Walter Rauschenbusch wrote a book called Christianizing the Social Order. He was a liberal progressive Christian. Who writes Christianizing the Social Order today? Mm-hmm. Jerry Falwell. Mm-hmm. So the right kind of took it up. But Reinhold Niebuhr was part of that tradition. And my teacher was a man named Jim Gustafson, blessed memory, he's still alive. And Jim wrote a book called Can Ethics Be Christian? And I raised the question, how did a tradition that began with Christianizing the social order end with the book Can Ethics Be Christian? And my answer is very simple. The subject of Christian ethics in America was always America. And you got what you wanted, the Americanization of the church. Why do you have to go to church when, you know, you can go to Kiwanis? So how the church can reclaim an identity that has to do with the worship of God is a big challenge, but, you know, that's, again, I say we're free. It's not bad.
Speaking as a Catholic, I mean, I've always been just amused at how this Christianizing the social order has always been such a Protestant thing. It's something that Catholics started to take up after the Second World War when they got rich and middle class. And
went to Notre Dame.
Or Harvard. Right. I mean, rather than going to Notre Dame. I just note that. I find that that's...
Though Rerum Novarum, Leo XIII says, we are going to penetrate, I find that an interesting word, all of culture with the Christian way of life. So that's not exactly Christianizing the social order, but it's pretty close.
Pretty close.
Well, you know, Tracy Fessenden and her called Religion and the Secular makes an interesting argument that the American project of the secular is a Protestant construction. And so, you know, the conceit of a theologically neutral or ideological neutral space is itself a Protestant illusion. May I ask one question kind of related to that? And it's that this distinction you're making, Gene, between illusion and love is... makes sense, I think, only on the basis of a richly detailed theological...
well, let me be clear. Allusion to me... Finish your question.
No. that's the way I'm seeing the alternative in your project to this kind of endless spiral of illusion is through some kind of discipline or disciplines of a cluster around love.
I'm using illusion in there. I'm clarifying part of what Niebuhr's doing, which is using it in an anthropological way, right? In saying that everyone is guided by what he calls illusions or myths, right? Which are not falsehoods, they're not lies, but they are, in the sort of capital R romantic sense of the word, things that reason can't see, but that reason has to somehow engage with. I mean, so in a sense, I'm sort of toying with that notion of an anthropological understanding of illusion, where illusions can be, good things. The kingdom of God, meaning illusion not in the sense of a lie, but in the sense of a motivating vision, right? So in that sense, I'm saying love is a motivating vision of something that's there, right?
I encourage you to be resisting the language of illusion.
I want to, maybe I wasn't clear enough then. I there's a sense in which I'm using it anthropologically. This is the way political psychology works. And I think Niebuhr is actually not incorrect about that. And I won't say not incorrect, because George Orwell hates that kind of locution. He's right about that, I think. That this is what you don't come to a cause, I think, usually by reasoning it out.
You're
inspired by something in this, again, this capital R romantic sense. You see something that's there. That's why I think it's important to remember that visionaries see things. They don't dream them up, right? I mean, they don't.
But he means by illusion more than an anthropological description. He means. There are deep epistemological investments in his understanding.
In Moral Man, it seems to me it's mostly he's using it anthropologically. This is what gets people motivated.
You read Stanley's Gifford lectures, and the illusion or the notion of a key, a hermeneutical tool, or the utility of pragmatic value, and all those things become. Ultimately, the axis upon which all theological claims, turn, and so it's a metaphysical claim in Niebuhr. And so, I just like to know how you would then contest that. You could just say Jesus.
Contest what exactly? I want to be clear about.
That illusion, or the idea of illusion as a motivating, animating, interpretive grid through which God, world, and self are. Mm-hmm. Understood and engaged is not the way you would want to.
No, I would.
Illusion.
Right.
Or maybe it is. I don't know.
It's there's another word that he uses as well, imagination, which I think is maybe better.
I think he ended up with myth as the primary language, and because then he got confronted with Bultmann's Jesus Christ and mythology, and he said Bultmann is largely right, but he doesn't understand that there are true myths, and the true myths teach us about the existential character of human existence in a way that is true, but can't be said without the myth. I think the early kind of stuff he was talking about illusions, he was thinking of James. I think James' will to believe was operative in terms of that kind. Mm-hmm. So, Niebuhr, I don't know, he clearly didn't believe in the resurrection, at least he believed in it as a symbol of the presumption that there is hope in the world and you should never belie it. But I don't know if is God creates myth or illusion, he didn't engage those kinds of questions at all, because Feuerbach, I always think, is sitting right around the corner with Niebuhr. That religious convictions are anthropological projections, and that's about it. But they're profound.
But what's not an illusion is the ultimate reference of the anthropological projection as a description about the infinite value of the human species.
Right.
And so there's, I see more of a kind of Hobbesian pessimism in Niebuhr than that kind of 19th century evolutionary optimism.
The thing that I find, again, that I find, to invoke James here, useful in Niebuhr is this stress, which he just drops, I think, and again, it's one of these roads not taken, maybe, in Niebuhr's political thinking, is the importance of imagination and not simply reason. And the imagination understood as, capital R Romantics did, which is not, again, fantasy or chimera. It's a portal onto what's real and what's possible. Put my cards on the table. I think that's the thing we're most in desperate need of. It's not activism. It's not reason. It's imagination. What are you going to do once you defeat the fascist? What are you going to do? What's possible once you've overcome the bad guys? What are you going to do?
See, at this point, Gene, you got to just say, at this point on this question, illusion, truth, alternative, this is when I want you to tell me about being a radical Catholic. Okay? No, this is when I want to hear the story of radical Catholicism, beautifully rendered. And because that's kind of core of your.
I don't know. Maybe that's the next book. I don't know. Well, look, I'm not someone who, to reference an earlier question, I'm not somebody who thinks that Dorothy Day represents a golden age. I mean, I do think that Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker have a lot of issues, to put it mildly. But what I guess where a radical Catholic imagination would start, I guess, is not with moralism, but with a sense of the sacramentality of the world and of human interaction therein. It seems to me that's an ontological beginning. And all politics is rooted in some kind of ontology, I think, whether we realize it or not. And that's where I'd start. Now, what's the 10-point policy program? I have no idea.
Survive.
Well, that would be nice. Yeah.
I think about the imagination. One of the things that the imagination needs is language. And I think that's what Bonhoeffer was getting at, was the absolute necessity of learning how to talk right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not as easy as it sounds like just to say it.
And I love those final answers. This book, which I'm halfway into, it's, I've loved every book that I've read of yours, but this is something special, Stanley, the work of theology, and I finished just before we met for lunch as a sort of a tour de force an essay called How to Write the Theological Sentence, which we'll explore in coming weeks.
Can I end on a joke? There's one of the chapters in there is How to Be Theologically Funny, which I've been told isn't that funny. But I began with every generation of seminarians had a certain kind of black humor, and our humor was John the 23rd had an archaeological expedition over in the Holy Land, and the head of the expedition called him up and said, I have some good news and some bad news. The good news is we found the tomb. John said, that's great. He said, well, I thought I'd better call you because it might cause some reconsideration. The body's in it. And John said, oh, yes, I'm glad you called. I'd have to think hard about this. And so he thought hard and prayed and so on. He couldn't come up with anything. He said, I'm going to call up my old friend Rudy Boltman, Jesus Christ in Mythology, and said, because I know he's thought about this. And he called him up. He said, now, Rudy, don't get upset, but I've had an archaeological expedition over in the Holy Land, and, well, they found the tomb. Now, don't get upset, but the body's in it. There was a long pause at the other end. He got worried that Boltman just really couldn't take it in, and Boltman finally said, so he really existed.
Thank you.